Here's part two of my interview with Wayne Moss and Dean Moeller. We're picking up right where we left off, in the middle of a story about Bob Dylan and rainy day women.
After a few leprechauns, we weren't really capable of remembering paperwork, so we didn't sign the card, the time card. Okay, so when the thing came out, Forrest Gump came out, we said, we ought to get paid again on that. And the guy said, I don't see where your guys are even on this. And I said, well, I'll tell you what to do. Look at the liner notes on the album and you'll find out, because he was the first guy that ever gave us credit. Before that time, I mean, Pretty Woman, Only Daddy, nobody knew who played anything.
Dylan changed that.
After that, they kind of shamed him into doing the same thing. But anyway, Charlie McCoy's wife is really good at paperwork, and she got a hold of Wayne Butler in Missouri, wherever he was, and the guy that played the trombone, and each member of the band, and found out their social security number and all that stuff, and we finally got paid again. And that was the third largest grossing movie of all time at that period in time, which I thought meant we got a whole lot of money, but it didn't really amount to much. But
I learned in the book that that is a thing, that the musicians get paid on these movies. That's great.
Yeah, I've done well on Pretty Woman and a few of those.
Yeah.
This is the list of them.
Yeah,
oh, you've got a whole
read
list.
Those, honey.
Yeah, read that list.
There's one on Ally McBeal, Caroline in the City, Dirty Sexy Money, Dumb and Dumber. Dumb and Dumber makes him the most money.
Really? Believe it or not, yes.
Believe it or not.
I do believe it.
The Ellen Show, Family Matters, The Fastest Guitar Alive, Five Easy Pieces, Forrest Gump, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Futurama, Identity, Hootenanny, Hoot, and let's see.
Wow.
Welcome to Heaven, Your Cheating Heart, Isn't It Romantic, My Name is Earl, Nightmares and Dreamscapes, A Perfect World, that's that Kevin Costner movie that's so good.
Yeah.
Poetic Justice, Pretty Woman, Romy and Michelle in the Beginning, RV, that's a funny movie, Shakiest Gun in the West, Sleepless in Seattle, Talladega Nights, and Tick, Tick, Tick.
There is some massive movies on that
list. I know.
I mean, Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah, I know. And Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Man, I'll tell you what. You just couldn't fit it all in the book. It's impressive.
Sleepless in Seattle had Stand By Your Man in it, I think.
Yeah.
And so did RV. It was that and Little GTO were both in there. I played on both those.
So, that's you?
Yeah.
Stand By Your Man?
Sometimes it's hard to be a woman, giving all your love to just one man. You'll have bad
times. And in all these movies that so many people, somebody's watching these movies right now as we're sitting here and listening to you play. I mean, that's cool, man. That's so cool. The only person listening to me today when I leave here might be me as I turn on just to see what we did at the studio. So that's pretty cool. There was in your book you said Harold Bradley taught you things that you needed to know in order to not be a pain to everyone else in the studio.
Like that's playing softer. I'm used to playing gigs.
Oh, okay.
At a louder level, and he said, look, man, these microphones, they're from Germany. They'll pick it up, just turn down. And so he taught me that and a bunch of other things. Ray Edenton showed me some chords I didn't know.
And Ray, and rest in peace, Ray.
Yeah, he just died.
Yeah.
So did Pig Robbins. And not too long ago, too.
Mm-hmm.
Two of my best buddies.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. All you guys did so much for, at the time, you were I don't know. You were doing it because that's what you did. But you, did you even know what you were doing for future generations? Because that's what I was going to say. You did so much.
No.
For my generation, my kids are hearing.
Yeah.
These songs that you've been a part of, they're influenced by it.
Yeah, I didn't know. It didn't really occur to us. We were just signing the card over 3 hours and trying to feed our family, you know. So.
How many on a normal day would you do two? Would you do 2 3-hour slots a day, or would you do three sometimes?
Well, it depends on what year you're talking about. In the 60s, it was maybe 2 3. Mm. In the 70s, it was like 4. And stuff, and I said,
4?
Yeah. And sometimes I'd run overtime and stuff, and I just got to where I couldn't handle it. And just smoked a lot of cigarettes and ended up with COPD from it. And so that was a mistake. But other than that, I really enjoyed all that. And it just got to the point I couldn't do 4 a day. And so, it shows on you after a time.
Yeah.
And I wanted to quit at the top of my game, so that's what I did.
Well, I mean, you were still doing great, and then you recorded all these albums out here with Barefoot Jerry.
Yeah, that's what I proceeded to do when I said no to, you know, Elvis and everybody.
And then at that point, you were doing it a little different, where y'all wanted to live with the songs for a while in your book. And some of the guys that you were bringing in, they were getting weirded out because they're going, well, hey, they're used to the factory of 3 hours, get it done. And then y'all were doing it more like a band.
Yeah.
Here.
We spent 11 studio hours on the first song on the first Barefoot Jerry album. Hmm. Charlie McCoy was on it. He played the first note on it. And the conclusion of that session, he says, boys, I love you, but this ain't the way I like to make music. Call me when you get your ducks in a row. 6 albums later, we called him up, said, okay, we'll do it your way.
Yeah. But you did a lot of great music like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like you said, we were doing it more like a band. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd spend a lot of time on things and double stuff and overdub things and change keys and just do mess around until we got it perfect. And that's why I'm real proud of all the Barefoot Jerry products.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you still have t-shirts and all kinds of cool things that people can go to the website, barefootjerry.com, is that correct?
That's it.
And they can look at all that great, not only the music that was made, the merch is so cool. Man, y'all are hip, and you still are. It holds up. So the Monkees had something to do with helping area code 615 get a start.
Exactly.
And could you talk about that?
Yeah, we were cutting Mike Nesbitt, who was a Monkee, and at RCA, and he pulled to Dylan and said, I got to work on some lyrics, y'all take 5. And we were ready to record, we all had on earphones and everything. And I said, well, somebody play something. And so, the piano player started playing Lady Madonna, and we all jumped into it with banjos and fiddles and steel guitars and stuff. Country instruments, and I said, man, this sounds pretty good. I got a studio. We ought to cut an album like this, but we can get it released to somebody. Sure enough, Polydor picked us up. Two albums, the second of which was nominated for a Grammy nomination,
mm-hmm.
and for Best Instrumental Group of the Year.
Just on a whim, you got 5 minutes, you start playing, and that leads to an idea that spawns 2 albums, one that's Grammy nominated, and all that happened because Mike of the Monkees said, I'm going to take 5 minutes.
Right, exactly.
I love that. And then I saw that area code 615 made it on the Johnny Cash TV show.
Mm-hmm.
The Nashville sound has become a household word in the music industry, and it's become a pleasing ring to the ears of music lovers all over the world. It's the music that comes from the recording studios of Music City, USA, Nashville. And here with us tonight is a young group comprised of some of the best of those musicians that make up the Nashville sound. Welcome, area code 615.
How did y'all get on his radar for him to?
Well, he was going through a period where he was using a lot of talent that people normally wouldn't hear, and they were turning into a Johnny Cash show. One of them with Bob Dylan,
right,
and one with Mickey Dewberry and different people. But Eric Code was a little off the radar for country people. And so he had us on there.
I hear them calling down in the holler. I hear Kill. I smell the magic. Her daddy's cooking. He's got a heavy steel.
Had two, one of two gigs. That one, Johnny Cash TV show, and the Fillmore West. The Fillmore West was with Sons of Champlin, let's see, Linda Ronstadt was on there too before anybody ever knew who she was.
Right.
We backed her up, and that was the only two gigs Eric Code 615 ever did.
Really?
But the Sons of Champlin were on. The Fillmore West show, and Country Joe and the Fish, and us, and they didn't know what to think of us, and it was like the marijuana smoke in there was like up to your eyes, and so
spooked off some of the traditionalists.
We thoroughly enjoyed it, and the members of us that didn't get high. Must have it gotten high that night anyway, but we blew them away. And the newspaper the next day said we stole the show. And we probably did.
Well, I saw that Barefoot Jerry got a big following in Japan.
Yeah.
How did that happen? I mean, Japan, of all places, just... Did y'all go play over there and they got...
Well, yes. Charlie's been over several times. I went with him a time or two, and we played Nagasaki and Hiroshima, Kyoto, and the capital, and Tokyo, and we had a big time. And those guys had listened to Eric Code so much that they knew every note of it. And there was a guy, Dr. K is what they called him, and Hiromi Takutate, and he had a band who copped all the Eric Code 615 licks, and they had a nine-piece band, and where we'd overdubbed two steel guitars and stuff, they had that covered. They had everything covered. They knew the arrangements and everything the minute we got off the plane. And so that was a great experience, and they recorded it one night, and I said, "Oh, you guys, are you recording this?" He said, "Yeah, it's just for our own amazement." I said, "Okay, great," but when their amazement turned out to be a record, and
of
I
course.
Said, "Okay, and now that's on my website too. If you want, we got three live albums." On there is one from France.
Everybody get on your feet. You make me nervous when you're in your seat. off your shoes and plant your feet. Doing a dance that can't be beat. We're barefoot.
Barefoot.
We're barefoot.
Barefoot.
And Air Code did that one in Japan. And then Alive at the Exit End is another one. And all three of these, the different membership of the Barefoot product.
Yeah.
But they're all good. And so.
Absolutely.
We had some great players that went in and out of the band. The lead player from Moby Grape was one of them, Dave Doran.
Yeah.
And, you know, the musical director of the Crook and Chase show was playing piano. He also played sax. Just different people at different times. But they were all top-flight players.
Absolutely. Y'all had such an interesting subculture amongst the session guys. I guess nowadays it's so fractured and scattered. I mean, there's still the top, you know, there's still all these top guys down there, but back then, was it just smaller where the industry was more in one, it was more contained and everybody knew everybody, and then it was physically, you didn't fly in tracks from your living room via email. You know, you had to go there and you were hanging out with these guys, and it created this subculture and all these moments where you could go, hey, why don't we start a band?
Yeah.
And why don't we buy a place up here on Gallatin Road and call it the Sack?
Yeah.
And just that part of it seems like it's, I don't know if it's necessarily lost these days, but it's definitely a lot more scattered in that it's not as tightly formed as it was back then.
Yeah, when I got here in 59 and started doing sessions in the early 60s, the entire music business was 9 people. And it was, Roy Kramer, Buddy Harmon, Bob Moore, Grady Martin, Errol Bradley, and so on. So it was really hard busting in, and I think I was maybe the first one that did. Charlie came a little later, and there's some other people came later, but when I first got here, I was doing a demo for Owen Bradley one day, and I was playing guitar, and Grady Martin comes walking in their door, and he said, "Who told you you could sit in my chair?" It was a green chair. And I said, "Okay, I'll move." He said, "No, it's okay." Anyway, Owen Bradley came out and said, "Grady, you're drunk, go home. You wouldn't do it anyway, it's a demo." So that's the kind of, reaction I got from a few people when I first got here, except for Pig and Ray Anton and Earl Bradley. They were all very nice.
Yeah.
So eventually won over Grady and everybody else, and he's on my Guitar Heroes album, so.
Your Guitar Heroes album is sitting right here.
Yeah, you're not gonna believe that.
It ends with Mickey Newberry's.
And that's the track from here oh my gosh, the American Trilogy that we were just talking about.
Yeah, that's what made me think about going and getting that for you.
Wow, and then that Chip Young, Tommy Emmanuel, Jerry Reed, Grady Martin. Goodness gracious, I can't wait.
Jerry Reed is doing that.
That's that song.
I want to be George Benson song.
Yeah. Pretty Magic.
Yeah, that's him.
I grew up loving Elvis, listening to Elvis song, and I was the kid who a new CD collection would come out and they'd say, "Well, this is from the Louisiana Hayride," and I would buy it. And so a lot of my history lessons on music came through that, from that Elvis direction. And I learned about Louisiana Hayride, and I learned about Hank Snow and guys like that who were over there. And then I heard Elvis sing Tweedledee on this compilation scratchy, real crappy sound of recording. And I think they just found it on acetate or something. But can you talk about that for our audience? Just
sure. He was. It was. He was performing at this in Breckenridge, Texas. I had to stop and think. And I was. Somebody put me. I don't even know who did, but asked me to open for him.
For Elvis.
In Breckenridge. Well, I had been on TV and radio a lot, so I was, you know, well known in that area because I'd been working for several years.
Yeah.
And so I was on that, and I was not writing at the time. It never occurred to me that I was going to ever write a song. So I just did copy tunes that I liked to sing. And Elvis had, I think he had That's All Right, Mama, and maybe a couple of other things on Sun. Mm-hmm. It was right before he signed with RCA and really hit big. But he was really making a name for himself. So he was doing copy material as well.
Yeah.
So since I went on first, one of the songs I did was Tweedledee. It was a big hit by Georgia Gibbs at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what he was going to do. And so when he came out on stage, and somewhere along in his set, he looked over at me because I was standing right outside the curtain off stage so I could watch every minute of Elvis Presley, you know.
He's like 20 years old, 19.
I was 15.
Oh, okay.
I was 15. And he was cute as pie, let me tell you. He was cute. And had a beautiful girl with him. So anyway, I digress. He looked over at me and smiled, and he said, "This song's already been done, and she did a good job, or did it well, or something," and winked at me. And then he did Tweedledee. That's that story. That's my one and only Elvis story.
That's such a great story. I love it. Man, y'all have been a part of such great musical history, and then finding each other, and let's just for our audience here, how long have y'all been together?
Well,
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah.
And that. And that's the whole story I encourage y'all to listen to on Peter Robbins' podcast, which I'm going to link to in this podcast because, you know, normally if you're doing a podcast, you try not to promote everybody else's podcast. But I'm totally doing it because I think that they should listen to that as well to get that story, if you're okay with me promoting. Yeah, I can edit this out too.
No,
but
that's fine.
No, that's fine. It's weird. When we first got together, I was trying to impress Dee by telling her that I was a guitar player on Only Daddy and stuff like that. She said, "Yeah, I know. I wrote the liner notes for that album." So.
That's so cool. You wrote the, hold on, talk about that. You wrote the liner notes for Waylon's.
I wrote quite a few liner notes for different artists.
That's a big deal because those are, there's a lame way to do that and there's a really good way to do that. Mm-hmm. And those albums, it's like a storytelling.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah, I can see you doing that.
I did Willie's. Is it Phases and Stages? I think. I did one for Waylon. I did one for Dottie West. I did one for Willie.
So you kept seeing this Wayne Moss name on there. You go, there's that guy again.
I was on one of her early sessions when she recorded.
Yeah, when I was. In the early 60s, I had signed with, I was writing songs and I was, and they were pitching some of my songs and somebody, had a big hit on Diamond Records. And they went into Tree one day and they picked up one of my songs that he was going to do. And the producer was liked my singing and so Betty called me into the office and I met with them and he signed me up to do some things for them. And
Buddy Killen.
Buddy Killen did for Diamond Records, and Wayne was the guitar player on the session, and Charlie was the utility man, and Ray Stevens did the
arrangements.
Ray Stevens.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Did the arrangements. Yeah.
That's great. Ray Stevens and Charlie McCoy.
And Wayne Moss.
Wayne Moss.
And Millie Kirkland on top of all.
Yeah. Was she singing high?
Yep, she was singing high.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I've heard a story about Charlie Daniels got grabbed up and put in on a session with Bob Dylan. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, he replaced me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
No, that's okay. I'm just glad to leave. The way that happened, Dylan took a long time to get his ducks in a row. A sad-eyed lady of the lowlands started. We had a 2 and a 6, and he showed up at 6. And by 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he said, "I still got to work on some lyrics, y'all. Take a break." At 8:30 the next morning, we cut 2 cuts. All right, so when he started doing Nashville Skyline, he started the same thing, and I said, "Well, here we go again." And I got out my gut string and started writing my own song. It got on his nerves, and he said, "I don't think we're going to need Moss on this session. Tell him to sign the card and go home." So I did. And that's how Charlie Daniels got to be my replacement on Blonde on Blonde.
Wow. Do you think, how did they know to get Charlie?
Well, not Blonde on Blonde, but,
Nashville Skyline.
Nashville Skyline.
How did they, is it true that Charlie was just outside and they just went out and got him, or was that they called him probably, maybe? I mean, how did they know to get Charlie Daniels? Was he a known session player at the
Charlie,
time?
No, Charlie Daniels and the producer were big buddies.
Okay. They had written...
Bob Johnston.
They had written that song that Elvis cut together, I believe. It was a... It Hurts Me. That's precursor to all this, but now I'm putting it together now. Wow. What do you think... What was the magic of Bob Dylan? Because I hear so many stories like this. I mean, he was a great writer, but there's so many great writers. What took Bob Dylan way out there, way past just being a great songwriter, being known as such a great artist, and having the kind of sway to just do whatever you want in a session and keep people around? I mean, what gave him that?
The custodian down there heard somebody saying, or he said, "I don't know why the record company puts up with him, man. It takes him forever to do things." And Bob Johnston was in the next stall, and he said, "Because his last record sold 1 million copies, that's why."
Well, and that's what I'm saying. I wonder what it was about him that was making those things sell. They're great songs.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of great songs.
Yeah.
But somehow his great songs were selling millions of records. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I can't really answer that. I know when I was called for the session, I said, "Who's the artist?" And Charlie said, "Bob Dylan." And I said, "Who's that?" He said, "I don't know, man. He wrote Blowing in the Wind. Just show up." So that's how much I knew about Bob Dylan when I went in there. So people have asked me many times since then, "Well, how was that cutting with Dylan? Like, it was Jesus or something?" And I said, "I don't know, you know."
Yeah.
And somebody asked me earlier today, how much input he had on it. And I said, "Well, every time anybody asked him, 'What do you want me to do on this?' he'd say, 'I don't know, what do you think?'" So that's one reason we had free reign to do whatever we thought, you know, whatever came into our heads. And that's how I came up with the "I Want You Lick" and all that.
Well, Bob Johnston, you said he was the producer on those records. He must have been okay with the free reigning, you know. It doesn't sound like an Owen Bradley type session.
Yeah, Owen liked to micromanage everything. And
was Chet like that too?
No, Chet was one of those take three, take four, and you know, that's all he ever said. Cut a bunch of big records like that.
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, okay, one of you guys play 8 bars. That kind of thing. That was it. And so he was a pleasure to work with. Owen, on the other hand, wants to do it his way. And I was hired for a Ernest Tubbs session one time, and I didn't play things to suit him. And he came out and said, "Have you ever heard of Billy Bird?" And I said, "Yes." I figured if that's what you wanted, I wouldn't be here. That's the last session I worked for Owen Bradley.
Wow.
So.
Well, you didn't mind saying what you needed to say every now and then, did you?
No, I on occasions like that, yeah. I thought it was appropriate. I was playing, I just come off that Only Daddy thing, and I was trying to do that to Ernest Tubbs. He said, no. Have you ever heard of Billy Burton? Yeah. And, you know, but, and I could go do, just like anybody else. But,
You had developed a sound that was.
Yeah, I thought
yours.
I was hot, and he might appreciate a new slant or something on an Ernest Tubbs record instead of they all sound the same.
Not Owen Bradley.
And he didn't want to hear it, and so. So.
Hey, what do you think Buddy Killen would think about his circle downtown with all the naked people down there? Buddy Killen. What would he think about that?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Because I have people, I'm a tour guide in Nashville. Oh. So I drive a golf cart and I go up and down Music Row. So I'm there a lot talking to people and your name comes up. You know, I'm talking to people about guys like you that impacted the music we love. And so we get up on the circle and people see the Buddy Killen sign, and then you look just right past it, it's nine naked people, yeah. Right there, you know, the statue. And they go, "Well, was he into that?" And I go, "I don't think so. I don't know if that has anything to do with Buddy Killen. They just named it after him."
Yeah.
That's a bizarre
I have no
twist.
Idea who came up with that.
Well, if you notice the Owen Bradley statue at the piano,
yeah.
You ever seen that? If you notice, it's facing away from the naked people. And I just have one more question, and then I'll leave you alone. I'll stop pestering.
That's all right. I'm enjoying this.
Oh, good. So, Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
All right. That's iconic, as everybody knows. And the movie only made it that much more famous. I can be on my golf cart tour, or I can be anywhere and go and just do that, and people know what I'm talking about. So, who we were talking about, who micromanages sessions or who lets people do stuff just free reign. On that session, who was the producer? Was it micromanaged? Who suggested that lick? Did you just play it? Was Roy inputting in on that? Roy Orbison? How did that come together?
Okay, that's a long story, but. The guitar player that was working with Roy at the time, they kind of sort of worked it up before he came into session. Billy Sanford was his name.
I know Billy.
Okay, yeah. And Billy was playing da 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 da. So it was like Lucille was what he was playing, you know, like Little Richard lick.
Okay.
Da 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 da. And so Fred Foster said, "We need to do something to make this a little different." So I suggested an F sharp note in the da 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 da. That stuck. And as a matter of fact, you can go to the Musicians Hall of Fame and they have a video where Fred Foster explains that. For any tourists that might want to check it out. And that's where my Pretty Woman guitar lives.
I've seen it there.
Yeah.
I love that museum. That's a great museum.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's all right. Yeah. But anyway, it was sort of predetermined before he came into the studio, but the one note that I added that changed it bad enough to not get sued. and it hung... got rather famous. And
I bet Roy was so excited hearing that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I bet he was excited about that.
Well, that's the ringtone on my phone, so.
Yeah.
I'm glad it didn't go off while we were talking, but it's...
The ringtone on your phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's... You are your own ringtone.
Yes.
I love it. And that guitar is on display at Musicians Hall of Fame,
yes,
as you
it.
Said. And there's an amp out here in the studio that's super special that you got from, didn't you get it, how'd you, what was the story? It's in your book. You replaced somebody in a band and you got their amp.
Oh, that's a good story.
Yeah.
I was working with the Casuals, and the guitar player that played with them before I joined was doing the road with them in, I don't know where. And he said, I've had it. Stop the car. Let me out. I quit. Give me my guitar. And they said, what about your amp? It's all the way in the back of the trailer, man. Just keep it. I inherited that amp. And it was one of the first Fender Twin amps ever built. I don't remember the serial number on it, but it was very old. And so I inherited that amp and used it for a lot of years.
It still sits in your Cinderella studio here.
Not anymore, I sold it.
Oh, you sold it, oh, okay. I read that in the book. So, I keep thinking of stuff. You did a show with a bear? What?
We did one yesterday. What? And he said, don't hit any rim shots on the drums, it scares the bear. And our drummer, Billy Smith, didn't remember that, and he hit a couple of rim shots, and that bear came unglued, and so,
where's this bear at? Was he in a cage?
No, he was loose. Had a muzzle on and stuff, but it, you know, there's no telling what you'll end up doing on the road. But I'm glad to be off of it.
Okay, yeah. Well, hey, that's a great note to wrap up on. I just thought that was great. The bear's running free with a muzzle. Yeah. Anyway, great stories, and I will end it again by saying y'all are you just have such a family atmosphere here, and I appreciate you letting me come here.
My pleasure.
I have felt free to ask you anything, and I know I've taken a lot of your time, and
I have plenty of time.
Well, you can spend that time on plenty of other things than sitting here listening to me ramble on. Your accomplishments are in stone. They're in the Musicians Hall of Fame. They're on Google. They're on everywhere. They're there. But it's the stories behind the accomplishments. It's who you are. It's who you are, Misty. The way y'all carry yourselves. The love that you've put into your projects. Invested into your life. The way you treat others. That's what I think. You know that saying, people may not remember what you say or do, but they remember how you make them feel?
Mm-hmm.
Well, your music has made me feel wonderful my entire life. Even music I didn't even know you were on until today, some of it. But being around you is very consistent with how your music makes people feel. So thank you for that.
You're quite welcome.
Yeah.
A pleasure.
And, God bless you both, and I will keep coming to Cinderella Studio as long as you'll let me. All right?
It'll be here.
All right.
The door is open.
All right, friends. That concludes my interview with Wayne Moss and his wife, Dee Muller. I appreciate y'all taking the time to listen. Now, this is a two-parter, so if you just heard this episode, make sure you go back and listen to part one. There's a lot of great stuff in that one as well. I'm going to leave you with one final song playing, just a sample. Make sure you get this CD, because you can hear all of the amazing tracks on Wayne Moss's Guitar Heroes album. And this was his first Guitar Hero, Chet Atkins. Go to barefootjerry.com.